All right, welcome to class today.
Glad to see you all here.
Before we begin, are there comments, questions, concerns, other things for me? Okay.
Let's look at the online quiz.
We're doing reasonably well. There's a few things we'll talk about it, including a question that after I describe it, you'll be a little upset with me, but that's all right. First one was probably the worst, we did. What's the problem with this proof? Why doesn't this proof work? Who can describe to me in just sort of however, whatever language you want, writing one of the options, what's the problem with this proof? Yeah. Right, so once I get the one element set, the only subset's the empty set, and so my rule here that says because none of its proper subsets contains doesn't hold, because proper subsets are empty sets, right? So the set of one thing contains an element that's in none of its proper subsets. Right, its only element is in none of its proper subsets, because its only proper subset is empty. And so as we look through this, we had somebody say that the empty set does contain me, which, okay. A proper subset can contain me even if no smaller subset contains me. That doesn't work. Proper subsets are, by definition, smaller than the set itself. So that is not a true statement, and also not the problem with this thing. The problem with this is that a set can contain an element that's not in any of the proper subsets, in particular in the case when the set has one element, which is where this one breaks. The inductive step does connect to the smaller case, right? The inductive step says you have a set of size x, and we're looking at sets of size smaller than x, so we do have a connection there. And induction does work outside of natural numbers. Questions about, yes?
Can you explain why C works?
Why C is the correct answer? Right, so what's a set that contains an element that aren't in any of its proper subsets? The answer is every singleton set, every set of just one element. The set containing the number one and nothing else contains an element, one, that is not in any of its proper subsets, because its only proper subset is the empty set. And that's true of every singleton set. Other questions? Yes?
Why is this question worth 6 points?
Why is it worth 6 points? That's a good question. I don't know. I don't remember putting it worth 6 points. I will go look at the point allocation and reweight questions after class. Yeah, it is a little odd. 6 points. I wonder what I was thinking. Yeah.
So then why is there one question that's worth 0 points?
Yeah, we'll get to that in a moment. That was intentional. All right. Other questions about this one before we move on? All right, we're doing reasonably well with the symbolization. This is, I don't know, wow. I must have had a rationale when I was assigning the point weights to these questions. I don't remember what it was. Anyway, so as we, this is to sort of like try to match the argument to the formalism, okay? Remember, our formalism is some, we have a predicate that we are trying to show smaller values means it's true at larger values. The predicate here, the small and large, has to do with the size of our set. Okay? We are saying if you have a size 0 set, then it's true of a size 1 set, and so forth. Okay? And so the predicate, therefore, is saying something about, given a size, the sets that are smaller than that or equal to that, you can actually do it either way, depending on exactly how you formalize it, don't contain me. And it looks like most of you got that. We have a smattering of answers in the other issues as well, but consensus seems to be where I thought it should be. Questions about this one? Yes?
So, in the beginning, like the example that you did, you see them like a...
Up here?
Like,
yeah.
Like,
sorry, I'm not sure where you're talking.
So, we have like a for all of something, an element of like.
Here?
No, sorry, the very last one.
This one?
Yes.
Okay.
Could you kind of like explain like how we have for all like on the outside and like what like the principal ones inside the predicate is for, kind of? Because we have like the for all. Like outside the predicate.
There's only one for all on this line.
Like inside like the P of something, like for like the responses, I guess. It's like if you scroll down to like.
Oh, you're not talking over there. Okay, you're talking over here.
Yeah, and then like within we also have like another for all, so like it's for all, like, for all something.
I don't see one with two for alls.
So we have like the for all that's outside, like.
There's only one for all on any of these that have a for all.
So there's one inside these responses, and there's like one like up there, like the. Examples like we're trying to find the predicate that kind of fits.
Oh, so you're saying how do I match the two? No?
Sure.
I don't understand what you're asking, so I don't know how to answer it. Can anybody, yes?
I think you said like, so there's a quantifier outside of the predicate, like up there.
So there's a quantifier out here, yes? Yeah, so this predicate out here is about sizes. For all numbers, the predicate is true of that number. So it's saying if you pick any natural number, something is true of that natural number. What is true of that natural number? That every set of that size, or every set smaller than that size, you can word it either way, has this property. So for every number you can pick, for every set that's that size, something holds. So a predicate with its variable instantiated or quantified is a proposition. A proposition is true or false. A predicate is a function that gives you true or false. So if you give that function some value, it becomes a proposition. Why is which quantifier? This one or the one up above? The one here. Because I am making a claim about all sets. If we go back up to this statement, okay, our claim is that no set of humans contains. This is a universal statement about sets. All of the sets do not contain. And then the proof is going by one size at a time, right? It's taking the size of the set as the thing we're inducing on. So for any given size, I need to say all of the sets of that size. Other questions? Okay. And this was more naturally strong induction because it was looking at all smaller sizes. How do I know it was strong induction? The text here says none of its proper subsets. Its proper subsets could be one size smaller or any larger size smaller, which puts it in the strong induction space. The second one, weak induction, and we were doing a little better here. We have this question, is the theorem is correct, is the proof correct? And why is this worth 0 points with no correct answer? So we were split close to half and half whether this is a correct proof or not. Would somebody like to identify a weakness in the proof? Why don't you turn with your neighbor? There's a reasonable chance your neighbor and you will have disagreed. Is this a correct proof? Try to find a reason why it would be, a reason why it wouldn't be. We'll get to you in a moment. Let me just share what I think, then we'll take any questions and see what you think. Most of this logic is fine. However, as worded, You can see this as saying we're creating a power set to contain only two things. So one way of saying including in the power set is to say I have in my power set, and this set, two sets. So if you think about it being a set of two sets, then it is incorrect. If you think of it as being a set that is the union of these two sets, then it would be a correct proof. And there is ambiguity in the wording, which is why I didn't actually take points one way or the other, depending on what you said here. However, I'm happy to discuss other potential weaknesses or strengths of this proof. Thoughts, comments, questions about this proof? Yes?
How does the second set have 2n to the minus 1? Isn't the one that's taken out added back when you do the OR?
Okay, so I'm doing a union, not an OR, but yes. So you're saying I'm adding back in the thing I took out. Okay, how many A's are there? So I have A is, I have one A for every one of this set. That had 2 to the n minus 1. And each one of those is contributing one entry to this set. So this has 2 to the n minus 1 entries, as does this. They're different entries because all of these have x and none of these have x. But they both have the same number of entries. Other questions or follow-ons to that? Yes?
A is a member of, is that P like some predicate or is that a power set?
Oh, that should be a power set. That is wrong typeface. Yeah, that is the wrong typeface. Sorry about that.
So I just didn't really know what the proof of kindness said.
Another reason why I shouldn't tell you whether it's correct or not. Other questions? Okay, so we're doing reasonably well at symbolizing this, although less consistency is what we thought the predicate should be. Again, this is a claim about we're inducing on, oh wow, there's a missing vertical bar too. We're inducing on the size of S, we're inducing on natural numbers, so this for all will be over natural numbers, just as the symbol has, and therefore we need to be able to say something about sets. And so whether you want to have the for all symbol or not, probably the for all symbol is more correct. But we're saying that every set of a particular size has this size. This is the claim that we are inducing on, the claim of the proof itself. And this is weak induction because we're only depending on one size smaller, not every size smaller, to make it happen. Other questions about our online quiz? Yes? Sorry, can you say it a little louder? Why is the quantifier optional? So the quantifier is more correct to include, but notice the proof itself talks about a set S without any notion of quantification in the proof. Right? And we are implicitly assuming that it's universally quantified, but you could implicitly assume that it's a specific S instead. And so I'm allowing that same ambiguity in your formalism. Other questions? All right. So, today we're going to talk about prime numbers and related concepts. Probably many of you have seen this before. We're going to try to summarize some information. Now, some of you won't have. This is a topic that is unequally taught in pre-college experiences. So if you've already seen it all before, great. You'll have an easy week. Well, except on Wednesday, we'll get to contradiction, we may get a little bit to that at the end of today, we'll see. But we're going to start with this. If you haven't seen it all before, I'm going to explain it. Our textbook, Mathematics for Computer Scientists, has quite a bit of information here. I'm not going to go over all of that in class, but you're welcome to look at that and gain some more information. There's also plenty of good Wikipedia articles and the like on these topics as we go along. We're going to start with stuff that I'm assuming everybody knows and work our way through things that possibly not all of you know until we get to the things that we'll need the most. And let's just start by describing a factor. A factor of an integer. A factor of an integer, okay, is an integer that divides it with no remainder. And you, I'm assuming you have all seen some version of this definition in the past. There's different ways of wording this, right? But if we take, for example, how about the number 60? The factors of 60 are all those numbers that can divide 60 evenly. So 2 times 60 would give us 30, which means 30 is also a factor. 3, if we divide 60 by 3, we'll get 20, which will also be a factor. If we divide 60 by 4, we will get 15. If we divide it by 5, we will get 12. So many factors. If we divide it by 6, we will get 10. I think this may be all of them. Okay? Well, except of course, we have 1. If we divide it by 1, we get 60. What if we divide it by negative 1? Then we'll get negative 60. And we can keep going. We could have negative 30 here and negative 2. Okay, now, so we can defy and we can keep going. There should be some more negative factors as well. Being about an integer factor, we would have the negatives and the positives. Commonly, when we talk about factors, we want only natural numbers. Now, there's no reason you have to do only natural numbers, but natural numbers are more common. And if you just see somebody talking about the factors of a number, they usually mean only the positive factors, the natural number factors. Okay? They occasionally will also want the negative ones, and you'll have to know from context usually. But generally speaking, this is going to be the default. Okay? And so we're going to sort of assume that they are the natural number factors, which means we're only going to take these here. Questions about factors? Okay. This then leads us to a definition of prime. A prime number, x is prime if and only if its only factors are 1 and itself. And this is the natural number version of factors. Although, again, we'll just sort of assume that in most cases. So if its only factors are 1 in itself, then it is prime. If it has any other natural number factors, it is not prime. So the primes are 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, 17, 23, etc. And there are an infinite number of primes, which you may or may not prove here later, probably on Wednesday if we get to it. Questions so far? All right. With factors and primes, we now get into some things that we're going to use fairly often in computing, particularly in cryptography, but some other places as well. And the first one we're going to do is what's called the fundamental theorem of arithmetic. This is a big, bold sounding name, calling something the fundamental theorem. Anyway, the fundamental theorem of arithmetic is more sometimes also known as the unique factorization theorem. This says, for all natural numbers, there exists a factorization there's some factorization of it such that all factors are prime. Okay? And, not A, just and. I did it again. And the factorization is unique. So any number you pick, you can find a unique set of prime factors that equal the number. Let's go back to 60. Okay? There's lots of ways of factoring 60. There are lots of factors of 60. But 60 happens to be equal to 2 times 2 times 3. Make sure I get this right. Times 5. Okay? And this is the one and only way of expressing 60 as a product of prime numbers. There is no other way to do it. You can reorder this because multiplication is commutative. You can move around across the operator. But you only have this one set of prime factors. And every natural number you can pick has a unique prime factorization. One and only one. When we're looking at our factorizations, some of the prime factors might appear more than once. There is a phrase for this. We call this the multiplicity. So the multiplicity of the factor 2 is 2. There are 2 2s. The multiplicity of 3 and 5 in this factorization are 1, because there are 1 of each of those. And we will sometimes write this to make it clearer that there is a multiplicity. You can sometimes write it out with the powers instead to make the multiplicities explicit instead of having to count how many there were. So this is the fundamental theorem of arithmetic. And this will be useful in strange ways. Primarily in analyzing various kinds of encryption and so forth protocols, and we're not going to see a whole lot of its applications. We are going to explore the properties we're going to care about this behavior. With this, there are two particular functions of pairs of integers we're often going to want to care about. We're going to want to care about the GCD, that is to say, the greatest common divisor. The greatest common divisor is the largest number that is a factor of two different numbers together. Okay? So if I were to example, let's just start with an example. If we do the GCD of 60, the GCD of 60 and 8. What is the largest number that divides both 60 and 8 evenly? And I could just try going through the factors until I find one. It's going to be 4. Okay. The GCD, however, we can think of as being very much like the intersection of sets. Not quite sets, because I have multiplicity here. Okay, but if I think about 60, 60 is going to be 2 times 2 times 3 times 5, 8 is 2 times 2 times 2. The greatest common divisor is going to be those common factors. Okay, and so here I have 8, here I have 60, and therefore here I have 4. And so knowing the factorization, the prime factorization of the number allows me to immediately determine the greatest common divisor, which is effectively this intersection of this multiplicity style set. I also will sometimes want to know the LCM, that is to say, the least common multiple. The least common multiple is the smallest number that two numbers both divide into evenly. So the least common multiple of 60 and 8 is the smallest number that both 60 and 8 are factors of. And that number happens to be 120. And I can find this by the union of these sets. I have 2 and 2 and 3 and 5. I have 2 and 2 and 2. So if I take 3 2s, a 3, and a 5, I get 120. Now, I say union and intersection. These aren't sets because I have multiplicity. But if we were to treat each of them as somehow unique, then that would be the behavior we are doing here from our least common multiple and our greatest common divisor. Questions about these definitions? Yes?
So for the least common multiple, why are you taking 2 of the 2s? Because those are the intersection.
I'm taking 3 of the 2s.
Yeah, 3 of the 2s. Like, why are you taking the extra?
I'm taking all of the 2s that either of them had, and all of the 3s that either of them had, and all of the 5s that either of them had, and so forth. So the most 3s I had between either any of the two numbers was 3. I take all 3 of those. The most 3s any of them had was 1. I take that 1. The most 5s any of them had was 1. The most 7s any of them had was 0, so I take no 7s, etc. Yes?
So, by least common, what do you mean?
I mean, this is the smallest number that both of these things divide into evenly. The smallest number that is a multiple of both of these. So it's a multiple, 120 is a multiple of 8, 120 is a multiple of 60. Therefore, it's a common multiple of both, and it is the smallest such common multiple. Other questions? Okay. So we have our prime factorization, we have our greatest common divisor, our least common multiple. One more thing that we're going to want to deal with is this notion of relatively prime. Two numbers are said to be relatively prime. So x and y are relatively prime if and only if the GCD of x, y is 1. This means they share no factors. Relative primality will turn out to be an important characteristic in efficient operation of many different algorithms that deal with integers in programming. Relative primality means you can sort of treat the numbers independently. And so we are often going to want to know if two numbers are relatively prime in order to deal with things. So 8 and 60 are definitely not relatively prime. They have a greatest common divisor of 4. But if we are to take, for example, 60, and then we are to take any number that does not have a 2, 3, or 5 in its prime factorization, so something that has, for example, 7 and 11, so 60 and 77, those are relatively prime. Because one has 2, 3, and 5, the other has 7, 11, and there are no shared factors. No shared prime factors, therefore no shared factors at all. And so relative primality will be useful in a variety of settings. Okay. Questions about any of these ideas? So what do we do with them? And many of them are going to have to come in somewhat advanced algorithms that we're going to look at along the way. Let's take a moment, though, and look at some that the textbook describes. Textbook goes into section 8 is all about these things. And it tries to give you various ideas of what's going on in these sorts of things. It gives notions of what divides things. And then it has like these random puzzles from movies about what can you do and what can you not do with them. It has how you actually compute the greatest common divisors, how to solve certain problems, some unknown things about prime numbers. We just don't know the answers to them. Random examples of old job interview questions that Google used to ask. Goes through the fundamental theorem and then sort of tries to prove that these things all exist. And then it goes into Alan Turing, one of the originators of much of computer science, spent a lot of time thinking about how you make prime numbers and how you encrypt things and so forth. And then goes into modular arithmetic, which is the core of most modern encryption today, and again has a lot of base on this relative primality. So you're welcome to look through all of this and understand what it is going through here, and talks about remainders, which are related to this other idea, and how all of these things work. This is not an algorithms class. I'm not going to go into all of these examples. We're going to use this primarily as an opportunity to exercise our ability to write proofs. Okay? So we're going to show various proofs that are going to deal with these primalities, factors, greatest common divisors, and so forth, and show where we can go from them. So before I transition, two proof strategies that use this. Turn to your neighbor and summarize what we've just said about primes and factors and so on. See if you can agree that you understand this topic. If not, we'll take questions and then we'll move on to proofs. Okay, we're going to use these principles with a new proof strategy, a very important proof strategy called proof by contradiction. Let's start by the simple version of proof by contradiction. A proves false, therefore not A. This is the proof template for proof by contradiction. And, right, if you can show that something is equivalent to false, then it must be the case that it is not that thing. This is going to be the primary way of proving things do not exist, which we will often want to do. A significant part of computational theory and some even algorithm analysis and so forth will be devoted to the task of showing people that what the boss wants you to do cannot be done by anybody. Here's a proof, so ask me to do something else instead. Okay? And this is a significant part of theoretic computation, of analysis of how computing works, is to understand what cannot be done. And this is the primary mechanism for getting there. Okay? So we're going to begin walking through how this works with an example, but first let me just remind you, when I have in a proof rule a something proves something else piece, that means I get to assume this to prove this. So I get to assume something is true and try to arrive at false, arrive at a contradiction. And we're going to start with a very simple, strange even, claim. Here is going to be my theorem. I'm going to say that 1/2 is not an element of the natural numbers. Okay, now, probably you see a claim like one half is not a natural number, and you're like, yeah, by definition, the natural numbers are 0, 1, 2, and so forth. Okay, we're going to try to prove formally that dividing 1 by 2 does not result in a natural number. It results in something else. And because I'm trying to prove something is false, the way I'm going to go about it is assume that it was true. So I'm going to assume that 1 half is an element of the natural numbers. I assume it's true, and then I'm going to try to derive from that false. Okay? So how can I arrive at false given the assumption that 1 half is a natural number? First, let's try to make our lives a little bit easier. That means that there exists an x in the natural numbers such that 1 half equals x. I'm going to turn my membership of into there exists an element of that is, so that I now have a symbol for what it is in the natural numbers. And I'm going to try to prove that this is a nonsensical statement. To say x is a natural number and is equal to 1 half, I'm going to try to prove that it is nonsensical. So let's just do this in pure symbols to start with, and we'll come back and add in some English. Here is my initial claim. I'm going to algebra to get to this position. Okay? There's my algebra. I'm done with algebra. Now I'm going to use the fundamental theorem of arithmetic. Fundamental theorem of arithmetic says every natural number has a unique prime factorization. Okay? So, by the fundamental theorem of arithmetic, okay, I have a unique prime factorization, which means that the factors of 1 have to equal the factors of 2x. But the factors of 1 are the empty set. There are no prime factors of 1. And the factors of x are the set 2 union with whatever the factors of x are. Which means these sets have different sizes. This is a contradiction. Right? This would suggest that 0 is equal to something greater than 1. Greater than or equal to 1. So I now have a contradiction. I started by assuming 1 half was a natural number. I did some arithmetic, appealed to the fundamental theorem of arithmetic, and arrived at false. Okay? And this concludes my truth. I say, since assuming 1 half is an element of the natural numbers led to a contradiction, it must be that that assumption was false. Yes?
Why couldn't you say that 1 was a factor of itself?
So I can say 1's a factor of itself, but the prime factorizations, it's not prime. Does that answer your question? Yes? Why is 1 not prime? The definition of a prime factorization is as two factors, 1 and itself. So 1, by definition, is not prime. Partly this is a definition that was made to avoid answering the question, what is the multiplicity of the factor 1? And the answer is infinite, which really messes up a lot of things. So we just define prime numbers to be larger than 1 that have exactly two distinct factors themselves in them. Other questions? Yes? Let's change it to thus. It was means, but that isn't a great word.
In that context.
Yes?
Was the fundamental thing, or would it take something you just use specific context case, or
something
like half of the context?
Fundamental theorem of arithmetic we use in a lot of different proofs relating to integers and natural numbers. I'm using it here to introduce contradiction. Yes? Can I read the line in the middle?
Yeah. Wow. I can only read it because I know what I wrote. Let's see if we can make it readable by everybody. By the fundamental theorem of arithmetic, there exist unique prime factorizations.
I should note this function p factors I've written is not a standard name. I am using it as shorthand to do the symbols. Yes?
So when you say exists unique prime factorizations, what are you talking about?
I mean, any number that exists has a unique prime factorization. And since 1 equals 2x, then 1 and 2x have to have that same prime factorization. Same because unique. There is one and only one. Other questions? Yes? Yeah, technically it shouldn't be either one. It's closer to union. If x had a 2 in it, then I would get both of the 2s. This is not quite a set. Okay? So we may turn this into more formal English here in a moment. But I have a 2 and other things. Not a 2 if they're in the other things. All right. Before I proceed and try to firm this up, and then maybe look at another one. Let me just comment. Proof by contradiction, the strategy of assume something is true, prove false, and then assume the thing you assumed is false, is something that a lot of people find just sort of doesn't sit well. In the space of logic, as it turns out, there are lots of different logics. And this is something that works in what are called the classical logics, but not in the intuitionistic logics. And if you happen to be a naturally intuitionistic logic person, you're going to look at proof by contradiction and say, that doesn't work for the rest of your life. Sorry. Because our entire field is based on lots of proof by contradiction. So to be a conversant computer scientist in theoretic spaces, you will need to accept and be able to talk about proof by contradiction. In my experience, 90-ish% of you will be fairly comfortable with this and agree with it by the end of the term, and 10% of you won't, and you'll think we're playing some kind of trick. And sorry, I don't know what to do about that. We use these a great deal in our field. Significant algorithms are based on proof by contradiction, saying certain things are hard, and therefore we can use them for encryption and so forth. They have practical merit in our field. And many of you will understand and accept them after a few more exposures. Some of you won't. If you're in that group, pretend, I guess. And you're welcome to come chat in office hours and the like, and we can try to help you understand them philosophically as well. But we're going to try to focus on the practicalities in this class. Okay. Let me try to take this same proof, and let's see if we can make it more formal. I started hand-waving. I added fake functions that don't really exist. Let's see if we can firm this up a little bit. Okay, so here is going to be our proof. In general, when we're making a proof, we always want to begin by saying the strategy we are using. So you will say, we proceed by contradiction. I've said this before that you should do this, let me just briefly comment as to why. We're trying to write proofs to be read by humans. And in general, we want the person that's reading our proof to believe that we know what's going on, believe that we're educated, and believe we're being nice to them. And so saying things like, here's what I'm trying to do, helps them sort of accept your flow and not be questioning what you're doing. You don't want the reader of your proof to be wondering what you're doing, because they may wonder about things you didn't want them to wonder about. Okay, so we start by saying, we proceed by contradiction. And then we say, assume 1/2 is an element of the natural numbers. Because proof by contradiction begins by assuming something is true, proves a contradiction, and therefore proves that the thing had to be false. Okay? Then there exists an x element of the natural numbers such that x equals 1/2. Now, technically what I'm going to do next is called existential instantiation, which we have mentioned once before. I have an exists statement here, and I'm just going to stop talking about it. I'm just going to act like the exists clause didn't exist. But I'm not going to pick a particular x. I'm just going to use x without telling you what it means, and because I'm not going to assume anything about it, except its natural number characteristic, then the exists doesn't sort of need to be carried around. This strategy, again, is called existential instantiation, but we're just going to use it. We're going to say, by arithmetic, that means 2x equals 1. That's not arithmetic, that's algebra, sorry. By algebra. And commonly I wouldn't say by algebra, but since we're sort of beginning this conversation and my audience is you, I'm going to say that. All right, so I've done my algebra. I now have this statement, 2x equals 1. By the fundamental theorem of arithmetic, one and 2x must have the same prime factorization. Okay, how do I know they have the same prime factorization? Because they are equal. Because the fundamental theorem of arithmetic says that prime factorizations are unique. So equal values have to have the same prime factorization, and there's only one. So I can talk about the prime factorization instead of a prime factorization. There is only one. Okay, so I have the same prime factorization. Then I can say, but, to introduce the idea, I'm going to try to get to a contradiction here. The factors of 2x include 2, and the factors of 1 do not. Now, technically, how do I know the factors of 2x include 2? If I wanted to go into more detail, I could talk about the idea that multiplying two natural numbers, 2 and x, yields a natural number, so that the fundamental theorem of arithmetic continues to apply. Here I'm assuming that information. I could include it in general. But then I say, this is a contradiction. And then I can say, because assuming one element of natural numbers resulted in a contradiction, 1/2 is not an element of the natural numbers. And that would be the end of my proof. That's time we have for today. When we come back on Wednesday, we'll see a lot more examples of fundamental theorem of arithmetic, related ideas, and proof by contradiction. I will see you all on Wednesday.